From WHQR Public Media, this is a podcast edition of The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're talking with Marlando Prigin, the Democratic challenger in North Carolina's 7th Congressional District. It's an interesting district that includes Bladen, Brunswick, Columbus, parts of Cumberland, New Hanover, Pender, and Robeson counties. That means it includes a lot of rural agricultural areas, but also the much denser development in the southeastern part of the region, including the city of Wilmington. Prigin is running against longtime Republican incumbent David Rauser, who's been in office since 2015. We reached out to Rauser's office and campaign several times, asking if he would be interested in a candidate interview, and he did not respond. However, we still do have over a week left in the election season, so if the congressman has time and is interested, we are happy to have a conversation with him as well. But now, let's get to our interview with Marlando Prigin. So before we get into it, I wanted to just hear a little bit about your background and what made you want to jump into what is it, admittedly, a big race and a tough race.
Well, I'm glad that you asked the question. A lot of people ask me that question as I go out here. So I actually have a background where I'm a tenured campaign manager running races for North Carolina House and Senate candidates for the last 6+ years. And so through running races for those candidates, I've learned so much, and I've learned specifically the major issues that are battling the counties here in the 7th Congressional District. And so I just decided that after being the student, really following the person for so long, candidates for so long, it was my opportunity to become the teacher, the person on the forefront, fighting the battle. And so I know the issues very much because of that experience for that. But before that, for me, I started my political experience in Greensboro, North Carolina, when I left UNCG, where I went to school, UNC Greensboro, as we say, after I left school there. And I ran for Greensboro City Council twice. But I did it as a political theorist, right? Coming, you know, you think that, you know, right off with the college mindset that this world is a great world where you don't have to be aligned with any party. You can be unaffiliated and run any race that you want and think that, you know, hey, as long as I can be the peaceful person between both parties. That was my mindset. I was a great theorist. And so I got there on the campaign trail. And let me tell you, it wasn't until the second time running that I realized that you have to choose a side if you really want to get elected. And so unfortunately, this two-party system took over me. And that's when I began to make my decision to align myself towards a party that was more aligned with my interests. And that's when I later came forth to be a Democrat.
Understood. Well, let's get into some of these issues. And if there's any that you want to jump in with, by all means, let me know. But we had a whole host from our newsroom that we wanted to touch on that we cover, where people often point to the federal government as the place where the needle could really be moved. And
absolutely.
You know, one of the first that we hear about all the time is environmental safety and pollution and issues like that. As you know, the southeastern North Carolina area has been dealing with forever chemicals, but it's certainly not just us. So I'm curious what your approach to that that problem would be.
So I definitely, this is one of the biggest issues that you see on my campaign page. And if you follow me, that I've been about, because at the end of the day, people should have security about their health and well-being, and to know that the basic part of this earth that we have, that we depend upon, which is clean air, clean water, that is a reality for us, and it's not something being second-guessed. And so for me, when it concerns to, you know, as far as PFAS, I think that my direct way of actually dealing with that is to address it in two different ways. One is that we can no longer be deniers the fact that we have environmental pollution that is affecting our everyday health. Like, that is a current reality. Like, Gen X is a reality. Like, we have our waterways that have been poisoned by these forever chemicals that we are living with, a potential threat to our health. So because we need to address it from that being a reality, we have to look at prevention, right? And how do we prevent those further health impacts that happen to our bodies? The great thing I love is that when North Carolina State came in and began doing actually research on the Gen X and PFAS situation, I love what they did with their research. They did a study by actually taking a group of a case study of a group of people and doing blood tests on them to ensure that they could identify that that was in their system. And then from there, taking that information and then allowing their healthcare providers to be able to assess what would need to be done in their bodies as a result of those chemicals being in there. I think that we cannot be after the, we cannot speak about pollution and environmental issues looking after the fact. We have to look at it from a prevention standpoint. How can we help that? And so one of the things I've already said on my campaign is that I wanted to have as a part of your healthcare is that there will be an environmental testing that will allow your blood to be tested and that that information be provided to your healthcare provider so that you can get any kind of prevention support as far as that, as a result of that. So that's one. I think that that has to where we second. The second part of it is that there are so many strands of PFAS and PFOS that are out there that just doing, and the salute to our, you know, EPA for actually coming down and categorizing the ones they have and really putting efforts to prevent those. However, with there being thousands of strands of PFAS, we have to move from it and actually identify PFAS as a class and treat it as a class so that every form of contaminant that may be in the water is actually studied and analyzed to ensure that it does not harm the American people in this area that are actually living off of that water. That's so important to do. I think if we second guess any part of the pollution down the line, we're going to find out that there are other carcinogenic issues that come forth. And who wants that? I mean, we've had everything from this Gen X and PFAS, from women actually losing their children. There have been testimonies of people getting so many different forms of cancer. And although there's no scientific data that points to say this does this, the realities of families suffering from possible issues like that, it's just too close to call.
So you're talking about a healthcare, an integrated healthcare approach here. I'm curious if we could go a little further on that, because I know healthcare is also an important issue for you. One of the things I hear from a lot, particularly in rural areas, lower income rural areas, is that the Affordable Care Act was a major improvement, but that there's still a lot of parts of the system that people just feel are broken. Beyond just the getting rid of the pre-existing conditions, that health insurance in general is still just prohibitively expensive for people. And, you know, lots of other knock-on issues there, too. So what do you imagine is something Congress could do to actually improve healthcare for the average American?
I think we have to, and you hit it right on the head. I think what we have to do is that healthcare has to be realistically analyzed to see what is available for people in their regional demographic. And what I mean by that is that there has not been enough attention focused on rural hospitals and rural healthcare. We understand that most of the specialists and most of our, healthcare support as far as doctors is in many urban areas. And so if you have specialized issues or pre-existing conditions, it's easier for you to find specialists because they are available in those urban areas. For a person who lives in a rural area, that means that now they have to add on the cost of transporting themselves to these urban areas, sometimes even having to stay there just so that they can get the support they need for their services. So one of the first things that I'm going to actually add on to this when I get into Congress is a focus at making sure that there is a rural healthcare and there's a rural hospital approach, focus that allows us to give the support to those areas. One of the things that the pandemic revealed, and it revealed to me actually on the campaign trail, was that in one of the counties in my district, the full hospital did a 50% cut in staff, and then the actual CEO had to take a 50% cut. Now, that hospital actually had something that was important for that rural area, which are regional clinics that were placed strategically in small towns and areas so that access to healthcare was easy for people who were in those rural areas. Well, they had 7 at the time. They end up closing 6 of the 7 rural clinics as a part of what because of not being able to pay the cost of the healthcare that was in that area. So what I realize is that we have to go back to where we're fully funding the cost of rural healthcare, despite the fact that it may not reach as many populations, but that it does serve a purpose to ensure that, especially when it concerns women's reproductive healthcare. And I always said this before, is that the problem they're having is that many times, my opponents on the other side, you want to see this as a social agenda, but there are realistic issues that are connected to rape and incest that happen in rural areas, and that access to women for healthcare is not there. They have to go to an urban area to where there's a Planned Parenthood so they can get the support they need. So a big focus for me is making sure that rural access is given to those in healthcare, and then also making sure that we identify those conditions that are specific to rural areas. One of the biggest that's important to me is doing a public health initiative around making sure that we have a clean, healthy, nutritional support to fresh produce and things of that nature. You can go into any of the major towns that are in my area, and I promise you there is like every fast food chain that could be in the area. However, there is not actually access to something that provides these people with actually full nutritional meals. In fact, in one of my areas, programs such as Meals on the Wheels that serve people and seniors with full meals and why they have it, it was cut from the county because of not having funding to pay for those efforts. And so I want to make sure that we have a comprehensive approach to healthcare for rural areas and to make sure that the costs are being paid despite not having demographic numbers like urban areas.
You know, many years ago, before the pandemic, there were many healthcare systems that were moving to value-based care and considered things like food deserts to be a healthcare issue. And that conversation kind of got pushed to the side by the pandemic. But I'm starting to hear people ask about that again.
Yeah. It's a necessity. It's a necessity, especially in the prevention of things such as diabetes, things of that nature. Many people are given, their health is actually dependent upon the food environment that they have. And if that's not there, if you don't have access, like you said, to those nutritional options there. And my biggest concern in our area as well is that senior citizens who don't have the ability to many times because of their age to cook every meal for themselves or even to prepare those options there. The older you get, you need a support system to ensure basic things such as a nutritional meal is provided.
So you mentioned women's reproductive health, a major issue on the ballot this year, without question. Where do you stand on the issue of abortion, both in terms of whether it should be a state's issue or a federal issue, and then what kind of regulation, if any, would you like to see in place?
So I always have addressed this issue as far as women's reproductive care as well as abortion with a personal point of view. So for me, it's very personal, and I've shared this out to many times to people that I've spoken with, is because I'm actually a product of a mother who was raped. And so the difference is and I look at my mother, who was one out of eight children at the time, who had to leave out of college. She didn't have the financial support or anything that she had in that process to do and to have other options, is that she was not given those options. Her father was the only one left there. She had lost her mother at 5 years old. And so having to raise eight kids at that time and having a child on the way of her own, she was not given the resources to be successful. So one of the things that I'm looking at when I look at that situation is that if we're not considering the life of the mother, and we're not talking about here just as far as the health of the mother, right? We're talking about the livelihood and her ability to reboot in life, to go after her goals, to actually get a living, a good job that provides her a living wage, and to be able to do everything else she has. We have to understand that that woman has to have the decision-making power to do what's best for her total life in that decision. And that's not what is being provided. So to kind of answer your points, the question you asked, I do not believe that this is a state's only issue. There are women nationwide that have this common issue. This should be something that that upon me getting to Congress, that I will be able to codify Roe versus Wade and expand the resources to ensure that women's health care is provided in the areas that they have it. And I think that we have to look at some new approaches as well, as I told you before, that are under the framework of the rural access that I said before, because I think that there are some social and mental health aspects to if we're dealing with a woman who was caught in a situation where she was raped, if she's a product of incest or anything of that nature. And that's the part of it that I feel like that has been the closed conversation, because it's almost as if that's not a reality. But let's be real about it. That is a crime against a woman. That's a crime against a woman's body. That's a crime, period. So if we're talking about this needs to be looked at. How do we handle the people who are sitting on the side of that abuse, who have been in that situation? How do they get mental health care? How do they build back the bridges and support to be able to do what they need to do in their life?
And so when you talk about federally, I just want to be specific about this. When you're talking about federally codifying a law, you would be okay with the viability standard that Roe versus Wade had held for a long time?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We've had Roe versus Wade, and it has been the standard of our country before Trump, before his effort there and before that administration to overturn it. We had that as a major point to keep them protect. And I know that it was there as a protection for women's and their healthcare. To remove that kind of a protection is to put women back into the same places where they're, where there's no support for situations where their life is on the line.
So I want to pivot, if I can, to some questions about ways that the Congress could support workers and small businesses. And one of the people, one of the questions I hear point blank from people a long time is about whether or not congressional efforts to raise the federal minimum wage would be beneficial for people in, say, the service industry workforce that we have here in southeastern North Carolina.
Yeah. It is beyond me the fact that we can go through this period of inflation that we have, where it is automatic, where we can be okay that prices have to be paid at the high level that they're offered to us. And it's a second guess to us of whether or not we should increase minimum wage. Let me tell you, the business, and because of corporate America and the way that business has been set here in America, the moment that we saw inflation coming to that point, it should have been 2.1 seconds before Congress should have said, we are increasing minimum wage to give the American people the actual ability to pay for the life that they want to have. And so for me, without a doubt, Congress has to do that, because in small businesses throughout America, they're going to be, and throughout that, they need the impact of a consumer base who has the financial capacity to purchase. And so it's a two-part system. So for me, without a doubt, we actually have to do that from a congressional level to ensure that we are impacting the economies in our states. And once those things happen in our states, I think that the states have a good bit of support to basically strategize and develop economic development efforts to bring back industries that we lost. One of the things I always talk about as far as economically from my stance is that in North Carolina, particularly in the 7th Congressional District, we lost so many economic industries, and many of our economic industries that we have now that are really, they're really in a bad situation because they're barely holding on to their capacity. The fact that we lost textile industry, the fact that we lost a big part of the tobacco industry, the fact that we lost so many other industries there that benefited to what people benefited to provide employment for people, without replacing those things, people are suffering to actually accept minimum wage positions with multiple jobs in order to get by. We have to give this area more. In rural economies are a little different because you can't do the same kind of economic development that you can in rural areas as in urban areas. So you have to specialize in what is actually important for us. And for me, my congressional opponent in this point has not done that in the 10 years that he's done that. He has focused on one industry, and that has been agribusiness and farming. He has not focused even on helping small farmers, actually, but he's focused on the big agribusiness. That was a failure to me, because in our local communities, the small farmers can thrive as long as they don't have the heavy competitors of the big farm business.
So one of the things I've learned over my years, I worked in the restaurant industry for a long time, is that as the pandemic caused a staffing shortage, a lot of large corporate chains were able to raise their effective minimum wage, right? Mm-hmm. So they're starting hourly wages to $14, $15, $16, $17 an hour in a way that small businesses, mom-and-pop diners, places like that, couldn't compete with. In a world where the minimum wage is higher, is there anything else Congress can do to help small businesses, you know, afford the increased labor costs? Because that's their number one, you know, that's the number one thing that they struggle with is to be able to recruit those employees and pay them.
I love it. And this is actually the substance of a conversation that should be had about our economic development in rural counties and in districts like ours, where you have the small diners that you said, the mom and pop stores that you have there. I believe that in the economy that we have now, we really need to focus is that in getting investments into small businesses that allow them to actually build upon their long-term capacity of staying in business. And so what does that mean for me? I believe that we should have programs that help continue the education and the actual career development of people that work in small, in small businesses. But particularly, like you said, giving the example of mom and pop stores. So I'll give you an example. I have probably about another part of my background is that I was in the restaurant industry for about 10 to 12 years in restaurant management, corporate, as well as on the local level. And one of the things I realized in that industry is that the best thing that a small mom and pop store can give to a worker that works there is credentialed ability to be able to build that upon there so that they can continue to do other efforts to increase their income. And so what that means is that, you know, paying for SurfSafe, SurfSafe certifications that allows that person to be able to utilize that in other ways if they want to. Also going into there and help them with educational efforts as far as into increasing the capacity of what they can do in their restaurant. So everything from management development to business development, there are so many levels of what we could give into small business on that level. But I think that it takes us being able to ensure that we have a perfect relationship. Well, I'm not going to, I can't even say perfect relationship, but a working relationship between congressional funding, state funding, and local support. And that's one of the things I echo in my campaign all the time is that where congressional has the funding to ensure that it can get to the small business, if you don't have a working relationship between them as well as state your state authorities and things of that nature, there will never be where the funding from Congress goes into helping the small business. We have to make sure that that works together. And so I would love a perfect program where I will fight for funding that will go to the Secretary of State that provides programming for anybody that is in the food industry to be able to get these things working under a small pop, to show apprenticeship programs where they're being developed in their craft. We can do those things, but it has to be from people who know what it is to work in small businesses and what it does to take it to them to continue to thrive.
The other question I hear from small business owners is about other ways the government can help small businesses. Obviously, we can't directly subsidize every small business in the United States, but are there other ways through the tax code that those mom and pops can, you know, help compete against just the strip mallification of small town America?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things I'm always, and I've always said this, is that anything that we can do for big corporate America, we should be able to do for small business America. And that's got to be a theme with us. It's so interesting to me how you can take your big giant companies come in there, and when you look at the tax benefits they have, it is astounding. It will blow your mind. But yet still to your everyday small business, there's no additional support, things of that nature that can be provided. I think that what we must have to do, and this is what I do, I love about my presidential candidate that she has there, is that this opportunity America means is that we have to identify where the best opportunity is to ensure that families are able to put money on the table for their families, and especially to specifically with small businesses. And I'll give you just one example. One of the things that I mentioned and many times before, and I said as a model, is that I believe that for every small business that offers additional benefits, that we should be able to give them tax incentives for any additional benefit they give to their workers. For many small businesses, it's hard for them to give them benefit packages as if you were a Fortune 500 company. But I think that we should incentivize every level to where that is given, to the point that it shows up for them at the end of the day, at the end of the year, when they're looking to see whether or not they have made a profit or not.
So I want to shift to another issue that I hear about every single day, and that is, and I know this is on your list of policies too, and that is housing. Housing and homelessness, from our reporting, we see them as being interconnected. I don't know how you see them, but from D.C., what would you be able to do, or what would you want to do about affordable housing and homelessness?
So that is a big issue for me, without a doubt. You might as well title me as the rural American candidate, okay? Because I say this often in all my questions, but there is a rural dynamic of our living that we're being overlooked. There are so many rural dynamics to how we live that impacts us, that we know that when they're making decisions on any board meeting in Congress, that we are not being put on the forefront. And so what I mean by that is concerning housing. What's so interesting for me is that in my district, you will probably see that we are, I think we are about either in the top 3 or 4 of the most mobile homes in a district, okay? So when you look at that, many of the mobile homes are not new within the last 10 years for mobile homes. Okay. These are mobile homes that date back sometimes almost 30 to 40 years, which basically they have no wind zone. They meet no wind zone requirements. And so you have families that are living in this, and they're in areas where that are most hurricane prone than anywhere else in the United States. So first thing I want to do is that let's provide some kind of justice to people in those areas and no longer allow this to be happening. You have many trailer home providers that are still providing these substandard homes that don't meet the thing for those areas. So the first thing that I want to do, and that's why I agree with you about the connection between housing and homelessness, right? Because substandard housing happens in our area because those families are the first ones to be totally devastated in the midst of a storm or things of that nature. And they have to depend on FEMA to rebuild. And when they rebuild, they rebuild back to another trailer home with the same instance. So I think putting some quality standards on housing that we have for people is very important, especially those that are in coastal areas. So that would be the first part that I would connect that to. Second thing is that with homelessness that we have in our area is that in rural North Carolina, our problem is that we don't have enough housing supply. So when you go to urban areas, you have different homeless shelters. But in my area, now I have several counties that we want to first start with what we can do. How about let's make sure that we have a homeless shelter that addresses both families and single individuals for safety in every county. I feel like what we do to the lower class and to what people, that affects everybody else in your county. But I want to start with the first level of minimally doing that to ensure that you have somewhere to go in the case that you fall into homelessness. And then from there, we need to create a transitional housing system in our district, right? Many people don't stay or will not stay in the same condition as they progress economically over time. But no one fits that, right? No one sees that. So if I'm trying to get up from there and I got a job and I finally made it, or I just got my reached my educational pursuits and I'm making more income, is there an assistance level there that helps me transition from that to a more permanent living situation? But transitional housing, and that also covers people from that are in second reentry in their point of coming out of prison who wants to rebound for themselves. We have to hit all of those strategic areas where people fall into homelessness. And if the prevention efforts are put there, then we have a stronger stance in making sure that we impact what homelessness, what many are in the area dealing with as far as with homelessness.
So as you work your way up these levels of, you know, economic stability, by the time you get to the point where you're, say, a police officer or a nurse or a teacher, you're making $40,000 or $50,000 a year, and you still can't afford to live in the community where you serve, is that an intractable problem from Congress's point of view? Is there more Congress can do there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the big, I think that I believe that we have to serve those who serve us. And many people don't understand that is the bedrock of how any community or county operates. And if you have teachers that we need that we highly need of, if we have law enforcement, if we have things like that, if we have affordable housing for those people, I really believe that in the long term, what it does is that those people would actually benefit and they will be assets to your area because eventually they will grow up in their economic capability. The problem I have with that is that it has to be addressed in a regional aspect as well as it is from a larger standpoint as far as with Congress. And that's where it gets difficult. And I go back to the point here is that there's a big divide between what happens congressionally and what happens on a local county level. But if I can't get funding that directly targets that particular issue, and I'll be direct when I say this. So let's say the moment I get there in Congress and I find out that in one of my counties, let's say for instance, like Pender or like Bladen County, that they need actually affordable housing to attract teachers there. If I can't put measures in a bill to ensure that that money goes and it can go directly to that effort without the monotony of going into the state and then being overlooked for these areas, then I've missed the point. And that's why I said before, we have to do better at strategically aligning the support to ensure that we are making sure that the people who need it get it, despite what area you live in, that all of the efforts are not going to urban or metropolitan areas, but that rural areas can have the sufficiency of having those resources available to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I can say is that it's difficult to build affordable housing anywhere, but in places where you can build more densely, you've got a better shot at it because it will pencil out for developers who are using low-income tax credit grants, for example. And that is more difficult to do in rural areas, both because rural counties want to zone things for low density, but also because you may have, you know, 100 people who want affordable housing in that area instead of 10,000 people. And so the likelihood that you can build a complex that makes sense for a developer who's going to actually make money on the project, because that's why developers develop, it gets very difficult, I think.
Yeah, it does. It does. And that's why one of the biggest campaign pushes that I always that I place that is on my website is that upon being elected, I'm going to have a working congressional office in every county. What I've realized, just as me personally working, because and I probably should go there, outside of what I've given to you as far as my background, I actually am I've been a nonprofit executive director working with people in actually some of the most neediest areas. But my first nonprofit executive director experience was in an area in Greensboro working for a group called Positive Direction for Youth and Families. And what we did is that we were a food bank that serviced families that were in between assistance that had not gotten the okay on that and that they needed assistance to get from day to day. And then also, too, we provided life training sources for young families that were getting started, such as teen mothers and things of that nature. But in that process, I had a great deal where we worked with the Drug and Mental Health Court, where we basically worked with parolees and different ones that were coming out to be able to be their support for food and things of that nature. And so a big part of that experience, what I've learned is that in many of our counties, and coming back to rural area here in Columbus County where I'm from, is that we don't have grant teams and grant writing teams to ensure that those areas can write for the most the best funds for things such as affordable housing. And so one of my biggest points is that I want to have a working congressional office and everyone that has grant teams that works with every county to identify what their strong needs are and to actually apply for funds that meet those needs and even regionally develop them so that we can work together as far as how we use our services regionally. Because we have to understand that in those areas when funding comes down, oftentimes funding could be limited. And that's when we will look at a point is that how can we work together regionally to ensure that if you're living in Columbus and the services in New Hanover, that you can still do that. And many times it's something small as a wraparound service as having transportation that can get you from Columbus to New Hanover. But that's a needed part that goes into grant writing that is you need teams to write that and to who understand that and how to show that there's a need for that in your area.
So I want to talk about two major mortality issues that have come up, and I know that these are on your radar, so you won't be surprised. I'll take them separately, but I often hear about them together, and that is deaths from firearms, from guns, and deaths from substance abuse, largely from opioids, but not exclusively. So I want to start with guns. I know that this is a difficult issue. It's been a difficult issue for my entire life, probably your entire life. But what, from your point of view, can meaningful gun control reform happen in Congress?
Without a doubt, I'm going to always give you an optimistic answer, yes, because I wouldn't be running for anything that we could do this in Congress. But I will say that I think it first has to come from a place where we get rid of this whole false agenda that you know, the opponent side or Democrats are after your Second Amendment right. This is not after any kind of change that we have. And I understand how we like to vilify each other from either parties. But I take this very sensitively because we're talking about active shooter situations where kids many times that are under the ages of 18 or 20 are the people committing the crimes and are also the victims. And so let's be honest about approaching it at the fact that we're talking about protection of our young people in the usage of guns. And I think that is the part that people miss. Without a doubt, I believe if we take away all of the other flaws from it and we focus on an agenda on how we protect young people in America in the usage of firearms, that could be a bill that can be passed where we say that we're going to put in these things just how you would have to go through the process to get a driver's license, how you have to go through different process. We will create our process for being able to understand how you use your Second Amendment right as a young adult. And being able to identify that in a way to ensure that mental health is checked off, making sure that we have tests to make sure that there is nothing that could cause the person to turn into a violent situation and use the firearm outside of a responsible means. We have to do that. And I'm willing to exercise any effort that a Republican on the other side are willing to do to ensure that we protect that. You can put 18 million different metal detectors, and you can arm schools with, you know, 100 different SRO officers. You could do that. But at the end of the day, we must ensure that the American people have a sense of responsible management on how you use your Second Amendment right to use firearms in any means. And I think we first start with directing it at the young generation and putting stipulations for their responsibility in the short term as they're getting older, but also in the long term to ensure that we have responsible gun ownership in America. And that's one of the things that I love about what Kamala said to, you know, Trump is that, listen, she's like, I'm a gun owner. Let's be honestly, there are Democratic and Republican gun owners. So we must be honest about the fact that this is not an effort to take away our right to bear arms. This is about how can we manage to ensure that those who carry the right to bear arms would do it responsibly and prevent violence for masses against other people.
All right, I want to move on now to the issue of substance abuse. And we see this intertwined with crime, with gun violence, with housing issues. It is unquestionably an epidemic, but what to do about it seems like a pretty fraught open question. So just open-endedly, I'm curious, how do you see America's drug use problem, and what can Congress do about it?
I'm going to be honest. I'm going to give you a practical standpoint on this. Many people in America are not honest about the means of what causes drug abuse. And I think when we are very honest with ourselves about what causes drug abuse, we can move with meaningful legislation to protect many individuals from the continued, overusage of substance and of substance abuse in that. And I'll give you a standpoint of what I mean by that. Many of the issues that we find where people are actually in substance abuse occur in areas where people have continued mental health issues. We have to make that correlation that many people that deal with mental health issues go to drug usage or substance abuse as a means of coping with the realities they have. And that is why I really believe that we have to move from a place to make sure that we have support systems for people that are in those areas of major traumatic situations. And for instance, and I'll start with one that's very dear to me, but our veterans. I think that once a person is actually, especially if the veteran has been involved in any form of combat, that the moment that they leave actually that Army life into civilian life, they should be given around the clock mental health support where the person is able to adapt to the new life as well as how to make decisions in a civilian world where they have to break that warfare mindset. That is something that has been dropped on a heavily basis. And I think that too many times we allow those things to happen as if, hey, you know, your life should be okay, and it's not that way. I also feel this the same way as when it concerns children that are fought in positions where they are in homes that they come from traumatic situations, whether it be abuse, domestic violence abuse, or things of that nature. We must ensure that there is support for that person on a regular basis to ensure that they can develop and to be able to live life without seeking out dependence of a substance abuse. Now, with that being said, I think that we also have to look at what freedoms are we willing to protect ourselves from that may be the gateway to many substance abuses. I believe that in many areas, and I'll give you an example here that's very dear to me, and I may get in trouble for this, but I'm known to get in trouble for saying things, but we have a situation where there is a vape shop that is like less than 2 minutes from a actual high school. And the vape shop there sells all kinds of things that young people would have access to. Now, the issue that I have in my area here is that there should be a rule where they should not be that close to actual sitting school. There should be specific regulations on a local area to make sure that those kids don't have the easy ability just to walk over there. And if so, we should have making sure there's monitoring to protect that they are not having that access to something that could continually poison them. And I go back to the point, let's be honest with how we talk about substance abuse. It is nearly available for anyone to get any kind of substance to abuse it in America. And if we're really trying to protect people, let's protect those parties that are in those particular demographics where that access could be dangerous and even to the point of ending their life. And so I think that if we look at that, and that goes into how you sell it and the whole nine, especially with now the, you know, the push towards, you know, legalizing marijuana and things of that nature, we must be careful to understand that there still must be a very well-managed system to ensure that there are protections for the freedoms that we have.
I want to move now to some big policy issues, some sort of national and international policy issues. The first one that we hear about all the time is immigration. And this is an issue that, again, has been fraught for decades. I think the center of where America is on immigration has moved pretty radically over the last year or two. So without loading the dice too much for you, you know, what kind of immigration policy would you like to see the United States move forward with?
Well, I want to first address, I will say, the elephant in the room when it concerns that question, because that's what it is. We are on path to having a actual agreement that we both stood on. Like, the fact that Trump would come in there because of his campaign, and I have to just put the nail on the elephant here, okay, and I keep saying the elephant, is because you knew that there was a bipartisan agreement on immigration that was heavily worked on by our members of Congress where we could have a solution working to this day. But because we are so polarized in our politics of Republican has to have their win and Democrats, you know, that Democrats have to lose, or however you want to put the picture, we now have delayed effective administration that we could already be moving forth with. And so one of the things I've already said that I am focused on when I get into Congress is to destroying the heavy polarization on issues that matter to the American people. This has been the most ineffective administration congressionally because of the infighting over polarized issues about who party has to win and who loses. But who cares about the American people? This is a problem. I don't think that we doubt solutions, but the fact that, and Biden at that point told Trump, said, listen, come along with me and we can do this together, because it's a bigger issue than politics.
I hear
it. But yet he had to have it. And I think that after this, hopefully the lesson that America learns after this election is that we have to take away the heavy polarization. If the candidate you're talking about is not willing to take away their D or their R for one moment to do what's best for you, I don't care what party they're coming from, they're not good for the American people.
I mean, there is a reason, I suspect, that the approval rating for Congress is in the toilet, along with that of mainstream media, which I am a part of. So I take your point, and you know, and yes, the reporting does show that Trump pushed loyalists in Congress to kill Biden's bill. So just to be clear, you feel like in a world where that didn't happen, that the legislation Biden was advocating for, that would be a good way to balance being a nation of immigrants with a nation of laws, so to speak.
Like, let's be very honest as far as, like, to the extent of this, right? Like, it's not just like, hey, just a nice answer on paper. This would have brought us a long way as far as an immigration law in America. This would have allowed us to really put forth a path that really protects us, as well as leads forth us with a way that we can manage what we're dealing with immigration in America. This bill was something that both parties put a lot of time in to ensure that we check the boxes for what American people need. And so, I'm very clear about the fact that I don't have to reinvent wheels going into Congress. What these guys have done is really good work, and we have to fight the people that are the naysayers who want to destroy our progress.
All right, I want to move to a couple of geopolitical issues that have been pretty divisive. I know you said you want to combat divisiveness, but these have been divisive. And that includes America's involvement, the United States' involvement in the Middle East and in Ukraine. And so I'll start with Ukraine and ask how you feel about the United States' current level of support for Ukraine, whether you'd like to see more, less, different. Just curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So one of the things is that when it concerns America, as far as our international representation, we must understand that America has always been the one to protect what is democratically freedom for everyone globally. Okay, so our support of Ukraine is about really a human rights issue, right? We're talking about a nation should not have the ability to go and impose themselves on another nation just over the ability because you want to have dominance. There are everyday people that are having it. We are representing something that democracy stands for. And I know a lot of people saying, hey, well, when it concerns the cost to that, hey, why do we do that? At the end of the day, our fight in Ukraine is really a fight for America, right? It's about our long-term plan about keeping ourselves internationally safe from what, when I say countries that operate like bullies, to ensure that they don't feel that they have the ability to come any further against our security. Now, the reality is for me in that is that you cannot win the situation with Ukraine by spooing out this kind of just language of destruction from our top person that I'm going to fix this with a deal here. And this is, that's essentially what Trump had did. What I look at the point of view is that our focus about our working with Ukraine is about fighting for a global point of to ensure that democracy is represented internationally. But also, too, that we're fighting for our ally here that down the line could very well be a support for us in as far as economically, and that we're fighting for that. And so I believe that every dollar that we have spent there to fight that has been useful, because Russia having a win on this would never at any point be a benefit for America. And I think that is the point. Now, the constraints of what we have to look at that is that there are ways that we must look at that I think that should have brought to attention of how we long-term support where we see our support for Ukraine going, right? Because we can't drain our economy on the fact of just supporting and just pouring that money into there. So at this point, because we've been in there, we need to look how we can strategically win, right? So that means that we need to do more focal work on making sure that internationally that we are looking at every kind of way that we can work to ensure that Ukraine wins this economically as well as for the freedom of those people.
So two real quick related questions. Do you think the rest of the world, namely our allies, are doing enough, or is the United States carrying a disproportionate load here?
I think that United States has always been a leader. So I feel like that there's not a way that we don't see being a leader. I believe, however, we do have a magnitude of being able to delegate leadership with a greater plan, especially of where we are in this fight between Ukraine and Russia. I think that if we were in the beginning stages, there could have been things other that we've done, but that's already past that point. But because we now have spent so much money into this, we're at a place now where every partner that we have in the UN should be united with our effort to do what we have to do to secure the freedom for Ukraine and the victory for Ukraine.
And the follow-up question is, and you alluded to this, but regardless of whether or not these comments are out of context, how do you respond when people point to degraded conditions of schools and roads and water and sewer and infrastructure, either in urban areas like Flint or rural areas like Columbus County, and say, how can this be the on-the-ground conditions in the United States of America when we are shipping money abroad?
And I'm glad that people would say that. I think that when a person looks at the leadership of our nation, you must understand that once it gets to Congress, we have the heavy weight of making sure that we manage our position globally for our nation's total security, as well as yours locally, as far as your everyday livelihood. And I would never in a million years say that even the members of Congress as we have now are not making those two things together a mutual interest of the people of America. However, this goes back to what I've been mentioning constantly through the points that I made to you before. When there is a disconnect between the White House and Main Street, when there's a disconnect between the White House and your local county commissioner or your local county commission, and there is no connection, it makes the people that in rural America feel as if all you are doing is fighting about this war and we're being overlooked. And I think what the everyday American is saying, hey, if you're going to spend this much time like you in over an international issue, show us some love here so that we can see that you're concerned about our families that have been devastated with hurricanes back to back and our areas that have not been built up after hurricane. Help us understand that you have a plan of action to ensure that money is going towards industries such as our public education that needs to be restored. Equal support in that process and equal attention is necessary, even though it's a big uphill battle. We must do both to ensure that there is security, that there is resourcefulness for all Americans.
How do you feel about the situation in the Middle East, and where would you like to see U.S. policy go there?
So I want to start off with the first thing is that the U.S. and the U.S.'s involvement in the Middle East, particularly with Israel, because that is the focus, right, is that Israel has been and will forever in our lifetime be an ally of the United States. And the reason why is because we need partners in there to make sure that we can have some form of democracy in the Middle East. However, one of the things that I think that we're learning through the process is that with our allies, and I think this is actually relevant to on the same page when we talk about Ukraine as well, right? We still have to have some really diligent management conversations about how our funding is given to those nations in a pragmatic way so that the American people don't feel as if we are dumping all of our resources into those nations. And so the reality is that those many of those nations have had lifelong war conflicts. The Middle East issue has been something that is all the way back to biblical. So the reality is that I'm not going to go into Congress in the mindset thinking that I'm a one person and that we can immediately just solve it. This is something that will probably go on past our lifetime. So what we have to think about is that what type of partner we have. And I like to look at it in a way that if I'm a, you know, I like to take it in a more practical viewpoint is that just as if this was our friend, right? Israel as our friend, we're going to give Israel the best resources that we have, not just in monetary support, right? But in also strategic wisdom in how they should move forward in the things that they do to ensure that human rights, democracy, peace, those things that America values that we stand for, that those people over there in their nation can have as well. And so the whole battle between them and Palestine is something that it's going to be a bigger issue. And it's honestly not America's position to solve it. But it is our ability to say, hey, everybody that is in your country deserves to have basic human rights. Everybody in your country should have the ability to have, you know, peace in their nation. And what we need to come through as us being these advocates globally of those human rights is that we have to come into those situations and say, listen, we're going to come in and we're not just going to sit down you as our ally, but we're going to sit down Palestine as well as and say, listen, we must come to something to ensure that all people are given their God-given rights of human dignity. And I think that one of the things that Kamala said, and this is what I stand beside totally, is that it is possible to still aid and be the support for our ally Israel, you know, as they're dealing with all of the attacks that may come from Iran to make sure they can defend themselves, as well as ensure that you go in there and protect the lives of the people that are being kidnapped and that have been raped and things of that nature. There is an ability for us to be as precisional, you know, and this is when you're talking about really honestly, when you talk about global warfare in this mindset, you have to be very knowledgeable of the fact that we're going to have competing interests. And if we're not very tactical about making sure that we are isolating individual efforts, such as we can do rescue efforts to get every one of those guys that have been kidnapped, those families, and to ensure that those families are protected. Just the efforts to make sure that the things that, you know, that the Hezbollah and different ones that we're trying to do there, that we fight on those arms to make sure that we can protect every life. That can be done in the same factor of Israel defending themselves against the Iranian, you know, push to try to blow them up and things of that nature. We can do both things. We are that precisional as far as with our armed forces. And I don't like the mindset that is very blanket to think that we cannot achieve what is honestly difficult terms of warfare. And we must look at it in that way. And that, I think that's the message that Kamala has, this message that we have. And I want to make sure that it's very clear that in no way, because Democrats feel that Palestinians deserve to have their lives protected and things, and that, are we saying that Israel should not also defend themselves? We're saying that those are mutually two things that can happen, but we want to make sure that we not give up on one for the sake of the other.
Yeah,
we can do both of those.
So I just want to ask a quick follow-up, because you're getting into a lot of the nuance, which I appreciate. I mean, I think a lot of people try to paint this scenario as either or, black or white. It's obviously more complicated. Right. And Israel is a sovereign democratic nation that can make its own choices. Right. One criticism I've heard of the Biden administration from the right and the left is that in different ways, they haven't exerted enough influence over Netanyahu's government, one, to further reduce civilian casualties, particularly in Gaza, and two, to avoid over-escalation in their conflict with Hezbollah, a proxy war with Iran, basically. And the concern is that they are pushing the region towards a broader conflict. And so my question is really, you know, is that a realistic criticism, or is the Biden administration kind of towing the line the best they can? And is there something you would like to see a potential Harris administration do differently?
I think that it's a conflicting point of view. And this is why I believe that's a conflicting point of view. We know the strength of Americans' armed forces, okay? And it's great for us to have the value and the confidence in knowing how we are. However, as president of the United States, our president does not have the ability just to wield out that power of armed forces for any reason or for any of our allies, because we have the capacity to do it. You know, and I think that in this conversation, we have to look at, for many people that give that criticism, no, Biden administration honestly is practically handling this in a way to ensure that the best of Americans' resources are not wasted in this mindset to fight a war that is not our war. However, we are doing it at the same time to make sure that we protect human dignity, human rights, to make sure that the people over there that are suffering in Palestine have some kind of way of survival by us being a rescue effort for those lives. And I think that is how you mutually, I said before, mutually contain the ability to be the best warfare, but as well as also the best humanitarian nation. We carry those things together to ensure that we have that. And I one of the things also too that bothers me about that is that the question I will wave to people who ask the question, like, you know, is America doing enough in this situation? I would have to ask, is that what more would you want America to do? And I think the answer to that question oftentimes is that people who know the strength of America or are making that argument want America to win that war for those people. And unfortunately, in that situation, this is not ours to be able to win a war. It is ours to be a supportive to our friend and ally, and to make sure that the people, which there are people who have connections to family in America, who there are people who are good people there that were kidnapped, that were raped, families that are separated, and that should never happen just unnaturally to any nation. And I would hope that for them, they would see that the United States will lead forth as an example to the UN on how we do that, because I don't think this is going to be the first or last situation that happens where there's going to be nations that have these kind of corrupt happens from other nations, but still have to keep some kind of peaceable state of arrangement between the nations. This is not going to be the first time that this happens. So we have to be that kind of global leader to say, hey, this is how you as an ally support the efforts without getting involved into the whole battle of statehood, which is really one of the biggest things that for many of the nations there that are fighting for is that they want statehood, control over nations, saying that that's not our war. We're not into the colonialism that was before on trying to capture nations and gain authority to do that. We are in the business, though, of making sure that the people who are the least of these are basically protected. Your children, your families, the innocent loved ones who should not have their lives compromised because of the backfeed of war or warfare between nations.
Well, those are our questions. Before I let you go, I want to ask if there's anything else you want to touch on. I've taken up an hour of your time, and I'm very appreciative, but I want to give you sort of your closing thoughts here.
Yeah, my closing thoughts, and I said this before to people in my district, and for those that would hear me, I truly believe that the people of the 7th Congressional District have only one option. And you have only one option of a person who cares about you. The difference between me and my opponent is that he has been inundated with big corporate interests in making deals for people that are on the corporate side of the ticket. Whereas I have been able to work with people who are suffering in the most painful, in the most horrific conditions in the area. And we are at a place now where, can you go another 10 years with corporate interest being the main thing that is being fought for you versus the interest of your everyday livelihood? And I just want to know that I am the candidate that I'm going to break the political status of what a congressman looks like. I'm going to be the one that is hands-on, not for picture interest, but that's going to be there at county commissioner meetings, that is going to be there in those state meetings to ensure that we are pulling together resources as a team to ensure that the citizens in my district get the support they have. But also in that part, I am going to be a peacemaker. I am going to be willing and unwilling to address and directly talk to Republicans who are sitting there, because if once elected, I won't just be elected to Democrats. I'm going to be elected to Democrats, Republicans, unaffiliated, and whatever party you stand for. And a candidate that does not understand that doesn't have a sufficiency to actually serve you. And I want to end with this, is that I had my best experience in this, in that this past few weekends ago in Sampson County, Mark Robson came by, and I had the chance to do what I've always wanted to do as a proud Democrat. And I called him out and I debated him. And my first question to him was, I said, Mark, I said, are you willing to talk to a Democrat? And when I first asked him the question, I said, my one question to you is, if you are elected, will you be willing to work with Democrats to ensure that everybody in the state gets what they need? I said, what I need to know at the end of the day is that beyond all of the different social issues that you guys fight us on, there are middle of the ground, everyday quality of life issues that we should be on the same page about. And I need to know that such things such as disaster relief and recovery, that those people in Western North Carolina are not dealing with some kind of Trump play about whether or not you should release funds. They know without that they can depend on the state of North Carolina to recover for them. I've got people with pods in my area right now, 5 to 7 years after hurricanes, that are still displaced. I need to know that you're going to make sure that they have a decent living and that they're not going to be overlooked. But that's my point. I'm willing to make sure that I fight the hardest fights, and I'm unafraid to stand the battle to do what is needed for the people of the 7th Congressional District.
All right. Well, Marlindo Pridgen, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, that wraps up this podcast edition of The Newsroom. Just a quick note on the way out, I will reiterate that we are releasing this on October 25th, so we still have over a week left in the election season. So if Congressman David Rauser gets back to us and has time, we are happy to have a similar conversation with him touching on these issues and, of course, some of his policy points. But for now, I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.